Welcome, everyone, to the Star Wars Role-Playing Game Podcast. We're going to be talking about the Saga Edition rules for the Star Wars RPG and how to bring the best of the galaxy far, far away to your gaming table. I'm Rodney Thompson, and with me is a man who loves nothing more than to contradict me in public, Stephen Radney McFarland. Say hello to our listeners, Stephen, and tell them what you do here at Wizards of the Coast.
Hi, listeners. Hi, Rodney. I'm Stephen Radney McFarland. I'm a developer here, and I do not like to contradict Rodney at every turn.
Thus proving my point. In today's episode, we're going to talk about campaigns. Long-running campaigns are sometimes tough to pull off, but when a campaign hits its stride, there are a few better experiences to be had. Campaigns are where memories are made that will stick with the gaming group forever, and we're going to give you some tips on making sure your campaigns don't end up stalling on the launch pad.
Don't get technical with me.
So one of the first things I want to talk about is recently we released the third Dawn of Defiance adventure. It's called The Queen of Air and Darkness. It is an adventure for 5th, 6th, 7th level characters, and I don't want to say too much about it because Steven here is a player in my ongoing Dawn of Defiance campaign, but needless to say, they are rapidly approaching the time to get into the Queen of Air and Darkness, and that bodes ill for his group because there are some pretty nasty combat encounters in there.
That's okay, Rodney. You can tell them all about it. I read ahead.
Oh, well, that kind of defeats the purpose of playing in my campaign now, doesn't it?
Oh, no, not really. I like your look of surprise when I do something interesting.
That's true. Yeah, the campaign's been going pretty well so far, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about how the Dawn of Defiance campaign can be used as a backdrop for your own home campaigns or to supplement it. But we'll talk about that a little bit more later. One of our upcoming books coming out in May is Threats of the Galaxy. It's in the galley phase right now. Galleys are basically where the folks in layout have already put the text and images in and give it back to us in R&D to go over and edit. Have you ever done galley editing, Steven?
I have done galley edit.
Really? What did you edit?
I did some stuff for Dragons of Eberron.
Okay.
And one of the Forgotten Realms three-part adventures. I think I did. Anorak?
Okay, great. Yeah, so thus far, I've actually been the one to do all the galley editing on Star Wars, but it's kind of our last line of defense against errors, our chance to go in and make a few last-minute changes. And now, Stephen, you can probably back me up on this. It's also a time when those of us in R&D get to mess with the typesetter's work a little bit by making our last-minute development changes.
Absolutely. It's always kind of hard when we want to add a paragraph and the typesetters come by and they start pulling out their hair and we laugh and say, just do it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the development process is, well, maybe not unfortunately, but it's an ongoing process that can last literally up to the point where the book is on its way out the door. Threats of the Galaxy has gone through all four rounds of galleys, even though they're only supposed to get three rounds because I was kind of stuck in editing mode there. But yeah, hopefully our typesetters aren't listening to this and hearing the smiles in our voices as we talk about making last-minute changes.
Well, it's always hard to let your baby go, mostly when you've worked really hard on it, because you're always seeing ways that you can improve it. Typesetters hate that.
Yeah. Now, Threats of the Galaxy was kind of a challenge, too, because it's literally the monster manual for Star Wars. It's basically got characters, droids, creatures, which means a whole lot of stat blocks. And when it comes to stat blocks, there's always one more thing to be tweaked, one more thing to be checked.
And then rechecked as you realize that the thing that you tweak affects other parts of the stat block. Yeah, okay. Stat blocks are fun.
Oh, yeah. And I don't envy our editors that go over them the first time because then I end up going over them four more times. One of the other products we have coming out this year that I'm really excited about is the Knights of the Old Republic campaign guide, covering the time period around 4,000 years before the Battle of Yavin. Now, Stephen actually got to help me develop this book. So, Stephen, why don't you tell people a little bit about the development process, what that entails, and why a developer is different from a designer?
Basically what developers do is we take design and second guess it. We second guess it at every turn. We put up the design, basically punch it in the gut a few times, make sure it still stands up, and if it does, right, yay, we have good design.
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up. It's a lot of abuse of the mechanics, trying to make sure that down the line, when the book comes out, it doesn't lead to mechanics that players can abuse. So we take the first pot shots at those mechanics during the development phase.
We also try to make things funner where we can, right? Not that designers hate fun. They don't, right? That's why they're designers. But we always try to instill a little bit more of, is this what a Star Wars character would do, especially in the Star Wars thing, in the Star Wars game, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think that the Knights of the Old Republic campaign guide actually had a lot of really interesting mechanics that came out of the designers, because one of the first things we did during the outlining phase, we said, you know, this is a time period where melee combat is really important, for example, right? There's lots of guys with lightsabers, lots of people with, you know, vibroblades running around, so we spent a lot of time tinkering with the melee mechanics to make sure that they all work together. In fact, I think that you did a You helped develop a talent tree for nobles on dueling, didn't you?
Yeah, I sure did. So I played the Knights of the Republic video game quite a bit when it came out and went back to replay it when we started in the development phase. I remembered a lot, but I knew I also forgot a lot and wanted to be able to be knowledgeable about the subject. And one of the things that kept popping up is I'd run into these nobles that always had swords that used to just beat me up. And I wanted to reflect that idea that nobles were very into swordplay in that period.
Yeah, I think that that worked out well. And I know it ties in really well with some of the stuff from the Tapani sector that one of our other authors wrote up. So that's going to be a really exciting book. We'll talk about that more as that book gets closer. Right now, Knights of the Old Republic is in the managing editing phase, where the talented Kim Mohan is going over it with a fine-tooth comb, making sure that all the changes that we needed to be made before the galley phase are done. So that's coming up, and we'll continue to talk about Knights of the Republic over the next few months, because it is a very exciting book. Lastly, I want to talk about the release of the Legacy of the Force miniature set. Comes out later this month. I believe March 28th is the release date on that. But one of the really interesting things about this release is that, for the first time, our organized play department is doing a cooperative scenario for the launch. Now, Stephen used to work in organized play a little bit, and I don't know how much you dealt with the miniatures, but I know that cooperative play is something that hasn't really been tried before with a miniatures game.
No, down when I was in organized play, Ian Richards and I, the guy who's in charge of the miniatures, both Star Wars and Dungeons & Dragons, always used to talk about what a competitive scenario would look like, and we really want to do it for a good while, so I'm sure they're excited down there that this is finally getting done with Star Wars, and Star Wars seems to be an excellent fit for this.
Yeah, I think so, too. I actually got to read over the scenario and help Rob Watkins, our miniatures designer, help Rob design the scenario and deal with a lot of the AI issues. I mean, basically, you work against the opposing forces, but you still need rules for those opposing forces, how they're going to interact with the players. So it's going to be pretty exciting. It is set in the Legacy era, which is the far future of Star Wars, and I hope that everybody will go to their local gaming stores and try this out, because it's something we've not really done before with the miniatures, and it's a great chance also to play with some other very talented players that are going to be at your store at these release events, and not necessarily feel like you have to compete with them.
Yeah, and the miniatures look great. And I don't just say that because I did some paint masters for it, because in my copious free time I do paint masters every once in a while, but they're very neat. They're very action-oriented and a lot of fun.
That's true. Now, you mentioned the word paint master. A lot of people may not know what a paint master is, so can you tell people what doing a paint master actually means in layman's terms?
Sure. Doing a paint master is we get the sculpts from China. The folks send the sculpts there, and after the art directors kind of tweak and make sure that the sculpts look right, they give it to a series of people who are talented miniature painters, and then give us some feedback and some design notes. And this set was really hard because while I'm a huge Star Wars fan, I wasn't familiar with a lot of these characters and really had to dig in and do some research to figure out what color lightsabers were, what kind of things that they what their costumes looked like and everything.
So basically, you were forced tragically to look at a whole bunch of comic books and
this
learn a lot
true.
More about the Star Wars era. I'm sure that was tough.
I know.
But we do thank you for biting the bullet and pulling through on that.
Thanks, week. Man.
Yeah, no
I
problem.
Appreciate it.
All All right, now we want to talk about our main topic this week or this month. We want to talk about campaigns. Now, the campaign is, I think, arguably the best way to play the Star Wars role-playing game, or any role-playing game for that matter, because you end up getting long-running stories, you get invested in your characters, and it gives you a great chance to explore the full breadth of the Star Wars role-playing game. What do you think about that?
I agree with everything you say, Rodney. Campaigns are absolutely the best way to play, except for maybe episodes.
So that's actually kind of an interesting, different way to look at a campaign, right? You can either do the very episodic campaign, which is where each adventure is pretty much self-contained. Maybe there's a little bit of crossover between one adventure and the next, but an episodic campaign typically ends up being easier to jump between adventures. It certainly puts less stress on the Game Master, don't you think?
Absolutely. They don't have to do things on the fly. They can basically focus on the action, and even the leveling up can happen in between episodes. And it's very easy to bring in new players, maybe somebody's dropped out for whatever reason, to an episodic campaign.
So let's say you're going to do an episodic campaign.
All right.
How do you plan that out?
Well, I probably plan it out session by session, right? I'd figure out how many sessions do I want an episode to run? It might just be one session. It could be over multiple sessions. And then basically figure out the chapters of the story as it goes. Probably wouldn't try to plan it out too far in advance, at least not episode to episode. And that way I can adjust to play styles.
Now, I've heard a lot of people compare episodic play style to like a TV show, right? And for example, the D&D game I play on Wednesday nights, Chris Perkins runs a very episodic D&D game that also has a lot of long-running story arcs in it. So I don't think the two are necessarily mutually exclusive, but I think that if you run an episodic campaign, it creates a lot of good milestones for your players, so that your players know, hey, we're progressing, we're getting things done. You know, this week we bit that bounty hunter. Next week we'll take out that hut. I think that it is also a little bit easier on the Game Master prep side of things, too.
And I absolutely agree with you on that level. I mean, the great thing about the episode, and all campaigns in some ways are episodic, because you're going to play session by session, and you always kind of want to end with a bang rather than a whimper, and players are going to come away and feel like it's an episode. But if you can plan more towards that, it's only going to increase that kind of player satisfaction in the long run, I think.
And it's funny we're talking about episodic campaigns, but the Star Wars movies are clearly broken up into six episodes.
Right.
Yeah. The only thing is, when I look at the Star Wars movies, they don't seem to lean towards the episodic campaign style to me. In fact, when I look at the Star Wars films, I think of them as maybe a series of episodes all clumped together, actually, right? Because each planet has its own storylines going on. The characters are kind of going off and doing their own thing for sometimes hours at a time. And it doesn't have the nice, neat little tied up endings always, which an episodic campaign typically does.
Very true. They also do things that you probably really shouldn't do too often in your Star Wars campaign. It's kind of the difference between the games and movies is maybe you don't want to split up characters. Maybe you don't want your young Jedi sitting on that mud ball for two sessions while everybody else sits around and figures out what they're doing. But there are also ways that you can figure that out. Some of that can be done in downtime as well. Maybe you can have text message back and forth for role-playing things in between when you do those sort of things. But yeah, I would say a movie definitely wraps up towards the end, but there are decision points and fun points in between.
Okay, so let's take the other track there. Let's say you're not going to do an episodic campaign. You want to do a big, sweeping, epic campaign, right? I've definitely been involved in some of these before.
Oh, yeah.
Where every session just kind of runs into the next one. There's not necessarily neat endings or beginnings. Basically, it's a constant. Many sandbox campaigns are kind of like this, right, where you're just constantly going from one place to the next. Maybe you progress a little bit on the plot. I think those can be pretty challenging, but at the same time, I think they can be pretty rewarding.
They can be pretty rewarding. You definitely have more room for character development that doesn't seem as story-driven. I mean, if you let it run and let characters figure out what they want to do and how they want to do it, it can be very challenging on the GM side to make sure that you keep the story cohesion while still reacting to your players.
No, I think that's a good point, and it kind of brings up two different play styles. On the one hand, I might design a campaign, and typically this is the way I do design my campaign, with several adventures in mind. And I want my players to go to these places. I want my players to experience these events. I want them to fight these bad guys or meet these interesting NPCs. Whereas there's sort of this other school of thought that a campaign should be mostly player-driven, right? Let the players decide where they want to go next. Let the players decide, hey, you know, I think I want to go suddenly become a bounty hunter. And now the proactive part is on the player's side of the ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways, personally, that's why I like episodic campaigns. Episodic campaigns allow the GM to do both, to react to what the players want to do, but still come up with a pretty coherent story that's got a big bang toward the end, and then they can move on to the next chapter, taking what the players have done and what they want to do, rather than shoehorning them into okay, this is the roller coaster ride I want them to be on.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now we've talked pretty generally about campaigns so far, mm-hmm. the episodic versus the long-running storyline, the player-driven versus the Game Master-driven. So specifically talking about Star Wars, let's say that you, Stephen Radney McFarland, are going to design the next Star Wars role-playing game campaign.
Ooh, okay.
Okay. How do you do it?
So I guess my first question is really who my players are, right? And I want to kind of see what they do. Now, that's very difficult on our end, as we have to make campaigns for general players. So I think what how I'd want to start out is you want them to kind of ease into the story, give them some exciting but low contact challenges in the beginning, and a lot of option points to let them sort of figure out how they want to settle into the campaign in general.
No, I think that's interesting. And you know, one of the other things that's kind of interesting about that is if you are game mastering for new players or for players that you've never gamed with before, you won't necessarily have a good sense of what's going to interest them at first, right?
Right.
So easing them into the story with lots of option points, lots of low-level challenges, kind of lets the game master feel out, you know, what's my player base going to enjoy? Do they like the action stuff better? Do they like the drama stuff better? Are they more into the Force? Are they more into the Fringe? I think that if you do it that way, you're going to end up with a more fulfilling experience for your players, which in the end will end up helping your campaign run longer.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the players will appreciate it, too, as they realize that their actual play is leading them down the paths that they want to go.
I think that's true. And one of the things that I've seen, I don't want to call it a trap, but I think it is something that a lot of game masters and dungeon masters in D&D fall into, is overwhelming their players at first, right? I see a lot of people throw tons and tons of backstory, tons and tons of plot at your players before you really even know what they're going to be interested in, before you know how their characters are going to shake out. How do you avoid overwhelming your players at first, I guess, would be my next question.
Well, probably just going with the base assumptions of whatever setting. I mean, it's very easy in Star Wars. You realize that depending on what time period you're playing in, that you're probably going to be good guys against whatever the forces of the dark side are out there at the time. Giving them sort of a wide open space to sort of explore. I think exploration in the beginning campaign. Exploration, especially that it leads to some form of action really quick, is the best way to kind of ease players in. Let them feel the campaign, let them touch it, let them smell it, let them eat it, rather than you just showing them pictures and saying, this is what it looks like.
I think that's probably one of the better ways to approach it. Now, you said something there about starting the campaign with exploration and then jumping right into the action. Now,
mm-hmm.
Most of the Star Wars films, with a few notable exceptions, start off with a bang, right? They kick off with, you know, the Tantive IV fleeing from a Star Destroyer and lasers streaking out and then capturing the princess, right? I think that there's an argument to be made that the first session of the campaign could be the most critical and maybe where you want to really ratchet up the action to hook players in.
Well, exploration doesn't necessarily exclude action, right? In fact, some of the best ways, mostly in a game that's action-oriented like Star Wars, is to definitely throw down and say, hey, here's the bad guys. Maybe put kind of a straw man challenge out there where it seems it's going to be very dangerous at first, and then let them figure out how it's going to play out in the end. And then once they reach the second challenge, at least they've got some assumptions there. So yeah, I think you can do a little bit of both. In fact, that might be the best way to do it.
It reminds me of a Star Wars campaign I started once where basically I wanted to impress the players with the idea that if you're going to be a Jedi in this campaign, it's going to be dangerous. It was set during the height of the Empire, where Darth Vader has already hunted down most of the Jedi, and I wanted to impress upon the players, you know what, guys? This is a galaxy where the Jedi are hunted. The Force is rare. They've eliminated most of the Force users in the galaxy. So what I did was I approached one of my players and said, okay, would you like to help me start off the campaign by playing a Jedi? This doesn't have to be your real character. In fact, it won't be. Go ahead and come up with your real character concept. But for the first session, I want you to bring a Jedi. And what I did was I had the session start, and the other players didn't know that this guy wasn't actually going to be playing a Jedi. He brought his Jedi on the run character, guy who'd escaped Order 66, and he came in, and one of the first encounters, Darth Vader shows up. Right now, Darth Vader's vastly higher level. He is far more powerful than they could hope to deal with. But Darth Vader makes a beeline straight for that Jedi character and clearly ends up slaughtering him right away. And the players just wide-eyed.
Man, I'm sure that made an impression. No, you never told me that story before. That is a fantastic idea. I might have to steal that.
Okay, yeah, that's... So far, that's probably the height of my good campaign opening adventures. But, yeah, it did exactly what I wanted it to do, in that it impressed the feel of the setting. It gave the players a sense of danger. And also, it let me use Darth Vader. Now, frankly, how often do you really get to use Darth Vader or the Emperor in a campaign?
Right. I mean, we see a lot of stormtroopers, but Vader, wow. That's awesome.
No, it worked out well. And, of course, the player wasn't upset that I'd killed his character because that wasn't his real character anyways.
Right.
So that,
but it shocked the other players, no doubt.
It did.
Good.
It did. But that was the point, right? But, yeah, that's the kind of thing that I like to see in an adventure kickoff,
yeah,
or a campaign kickoff adventure, because it threw players right into the Star Wars universe. And sometimes I think that can be a little challenging, getting across that Star Wars feel without using Vader or without using the Emperor. Now, in this case, I did use Darth Vader. But,
yeah.
Sometimes it can be challenging. And if you don't hook players right away with that Star Wars feel of the campaign, it can sometimes lead to the campaign degenerating in a hurry.
That is true. Although I did like the way that Dawn of Defiance opened. I thought that was very strong and enjoyed that first scene a lot.
And there were a few challenges with the beginning of the Dawn of Defiance campaign because we wanted to use it to teach people how to play.
Right.
And now if you haven't played the Dawn of Defiance campaign or run it yet, that may not make a whole lot of sense to you, but all I can say is that we ran it at Gen Con, actually, last year. It was the very first Gen Con Star Wars role-playing game event, and if you haven't downloaded it, you can get it from our website at wizards.com/Star Wars. Now, we talked about some of the challenges of getting the campaign started. Let's say that you've got a campaign, it's been running for a few months now.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, say, 10, 12 sessions under your belt. Things are progressing quickly and progressing well. What do you do to keep the campaign going? Because a lot of times I've had campaigns that will, they get off the launch pad, they'll get started and be going pretty well, and then something happens and they just die.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why things just die. I think you have to be cognizant of your player schedule and your own schedule. That's probably key in any campaign. If things start becoming too stressful for you or your players, you're not having fun anymore. And so that's a real life sort of thing that you can kind of watch out for.
So yeah, nothing can kill a campaign faster than real life issues. Sometimes there's not anything you can do about that. Sometimes, as a game master, you just have to be cognizant of those issues and plan accordingly. Now, aside from real life issues, which are going to crop up from time to time, what would you say are other challenges to watch out for?
Other challenges are challenges. There's nothing that that kills a campaign quicker than a GM realizing or not putting enough challenge or too little challenge, and that becomes harder as you go on. As you know, your players more, you're very likely to just throw big terrible things at them until they scream help. But the real weird thing about campaigns, and I've said this a few times before, is campaigns are kind of the opposite of Vegas, right? If you think about it, is the house always loses. You always have to feel like the PCs are in danger without putting so much that they can't do anything about it. There's nothing that kills a campaign faster than a bunch of players feeling like they're in a hopeless situation.
I think that's true. There's one thing that I used to run into, and I know I'm guilty of it too, so I really have to watch out for it, is as I see my players' favorite tactics, I instinctively want to challenge them more and give them things that they can't use their favorite tactics on. And that's fine every once in a while, but the real danger is, you know, okay, my players love to knock people down the condition track, so I'm going to give them a bunch of bad guys that they can't knock down the condition track. And that's fine if I do that for one session, but if I do it again and again and again, eventually I've robbed them of the fun tactics they like to use and have built into their characters.
Yeah, so, you're taking away their toys. Players hate it when you take away their toys.
True. And so when you're trying to run a long-running campaign, I think it's easier to fall into that trap just because you're constantly exposed to those tactics that your players are using. And in a convention game or in just a pickup game, you may not be so intimately familiar with the way that a player is going to play their character, so you're not as likely to over-challenge them. Now, that being said, over-challenging is really only half of the problem. What about under-challenging?
Well, under-challenging is difficult as well. And mostly when you're playing a convention game, you have to be really thoughtful about this, because you can over-challenge one player in the game and under-challenge another one, and you're gonna create a sense of frustration just within the group. The fine art is finding that happy medium to know when maybe you add one more stormtrooper to the mix, knowing maybe when you let a stormtrooper fall early. Now, I know what it sounds like that I'm advocating a certain amount of DM quote-unquote cheating, and I think I am, but you got to do that sometimes just to make the challenges feel right. It's really a game about people feeling like they've done great things, not a game about making a GM feel like he's done great things, even though, of course, running a campaign or a really good episode or a really good game is very fulfilling to any game master.
No, I think that's true. One of the things that I've really struggled with in designing encounters is finding that happy medium, because while we give encounter guidelines in a long-running campaign, especially if you don't produce appropriate challenges over the long run, players will either lose interest or become frustrated. And I think that, yeah, inappropriate encounters, inappropriate challenges, whether too easy or too hard, can be a killer. Now, we've talked about specifically combat encounters so far, but Star Wars is also one of those settings that lends itself really well to non-traditional encounters. For mm-hmm. example, chase sequences. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody loves a chase sequence, right? I mean, Obi-Wan leaps out of a building on Coruscant, grabs onto a droid, and a great chase sequence ensues. Or my personal favorite, the indoor chase scene, right? Now, those are just a couple of examples of interesting non-combat encounters, even though combat may occur during them. What do you think about that? I mean, when it comes to introducing non-combat encounters, like them, prefer combat? How what kind of challenges do you face in creating a campaign that uses a lot of non-combat encounters?
Well, I definitely love combat. Anybody who knows me knows I love combat. But the thing about making non-combat encounters really work is realizing that you want to play with degrees of success and little failures rather than debilitating failures. If somebody fails a roll, you don't want them to stop playing. You want them to get some form of penalty where they've got to shake it off and keep on going. And then taking a look at the degrees of success as well. And when people do a very good job because they've come up with something surprising or interesting and fun, saying yes, let's do something fun with this rather than just giving them the ordinary. So it's always degrees of success and little failures rather than debilitating failures.
Right. You never want a campaign to come to a screeching halt because, oh, well, they failed to make their gather information check, so now we spend three sessions trying to work our way around that. It needs to be something that keeps the game going. And, you know, side detours are okay,
mm-hmm.
but I think that typically if you have failure in the campaign, which you're inevitably going to,
right.
and probably should to tell an engaging story, if your players do fail at something, I think that you can probably argue that spending more than a session on a sidetrack or on a way around that failure if you spend more than that, that can be kind of dangerous because it can sidetrack the plot to the point where they kind of lose focus on the central plot of the campaign.
Absolutely. And definitely don't stop the action because of it. Don't ever say, hey, you failed that role. What do you do next, right? Always give them ways out. Give them ways to that sidetrack and have fun with it. Never stop the fun.
No, I agree. The sidetrack is a pretty important part of a lot of campaigns, and especially mine, because you want to give players the freedom to pick their own path, right? And even if you have planned out the adventures, planned out the episodes, and planned out even the whole campaign, a sidetrack is a great way to give players the freedom to choose what planet they go to next. Even if they're only there for a session or two, the sidetrack is one of those tools that I think a game master has to keep in his arsenal. Probably, let's say you're playing a year's worth of campaign, I think probably once every couple of months you want to have some kind of player-motivated sidetrack.
Oh, absolutely. You never know what players are going to latch on to. And any time that they latch onto something that they find interesting for whatever reason, some throwaway comment on your end, and you basically deny them the chance to go even do a little bit of pursuing for it, they're going to also feel frustrated. And I think that's part of the whole, you know, make your challenges worthwhile to the players. They're going to want to do things that they want to do, and you're going to have to go with that flow.
Yeah, that's true. So now we've talked about how to get your campaign started.
Yeah.
We've talked about a few things to keep your campaign going. Clearly, there is a dark side to the campaign, and that is, what do you do when a campaign fails? I know this has happened to you. Mm. It's definitely happened to me. And I would wager that a large percentage of the game masters we've got out there have had campaigns fail. So what do you do to keep the group from falling apart? Let's say you've just started, or you've been running a campaign, let's say, for 6 months, and it falls apart. What do you do?
Yeah, like a TPK?
TPK, or it could be a TPK, or it could just be that maybe your players have lost interest, maybe they want to change to a different setting. How do you pick yourself up from the end of the failure of a campaign?
So definitely what I've done is do a little bit of a postmortem, be honest about the failure, right? For whatever reason, sit there, step up and say, wow, I don't think that ended the way I wanted to end, and talk about what things you can do better in the long run, and also give feedback to players, right, on the same level. At the end of the day, you're a group of people getting together to have a good time, and you desperately want to have a good time, or you wouldn't be hanging out with these folks. And so part of that is just kind of teamwork and figuring out what works and reboot.
That really does remind me of a terribly failed campaign I ran. It was actually one that ran for 3 or 4 months. We set it in the far future. This is well before the Legacy comics came out. So we thought that the idea of, wow, a Star Wars campaign set in the future, that's a totally radical idea. And so I did a bunch of work on the campaign setting. I had like a 30-page campaign document.
Wow.
And players loved it at first. And what tore it apart was player conflict. One player was playing a droid. The other player was playing a guy that hated droids. It was kind of a setup from the beginning that I knew was going to cause friction. I didn't think it would end the campaign, but unfortunately, when the droid player took a turbo laser to the chest that was fired by the other player's character, it kind of went south in a hurry.
Yeah, you kind of need to talk to those players. Part of it is I absolutely believe in having the first session where people make characters and talk about why they adventure together, right? I mean, you can kind of stave off those conflicts early. There's nothing like player conflict to kill a campaign, even though player conflict can be very interesting if it's done within the story and it can motivate people as well. But I think a lot of ways solving the problems of dead campaigns is to be proactive in the beginning, see the problems that might be coming up ahead and trying to solve those even before the campaign starts.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the campaign postmortem when a campaign fails. Nothing has improved my game mastering more than knowing what my players liked, what they didn't like, too. I've had to learn a few hard lessons over the years where basically my players said, you know what, we really liked this element, but we really hated this one. And inside I kind of go, oh, man, I loved throwing those Dark Jedi ninjas at you or whatever, right?
Right.
And you know, our players will be like, yeah, well, we just don't feel like ninjas have a place in Star Wars or whatever. And it's kind of one of those times where you have to swallow your pride and put your own personal feelings aside and say, you know what, my players weren't enjoying this element of the campaign. I've really got to take a good hard look at why they weren't and what can I change in the future to fix that. I don't think that any campaign that fails is necessarily completely irredeemable. Now, I've been in a few that were disastrous, to say the least.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that the Game Master learning from a failed campaign is probably the best outcome of a failed campaign. Not that there are any really good ones.
Well, Game Mastery is a little bit of a science, right? Because we deal with math, and of course you read a lot of stuff and everything else, but it's really an art. And a lot of times you learn most from your art when you fail. Successes are great and everything, and you look back and you can sit on your laurels, but every time I run a game, I sit back and I'm like, so what did I do wrong? I saw smiling faces around. I know what people enjoyed. But how can I improve this thing to either make sure people have a good time, or do I just throw it out? And I think any kind of game master or even game designer or gamer in general needs to kind of look back when they're done and have that sort of self-evaluation.
That's true. And we talked earlier a little bit about the players who maybe their conflict is what brings the campaign to a halt, or maybe they're just problematic. Let's say you've got an ongoing campaign that's been running for a while, and you've got a player that's causing problems, and you can see kind of the writing on the wall that if you don't solve this, the campaign's about to end. I know you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I know. Oh, yeah.
How do you deal with, and maybe it's not necessarily a player, but some element of your campaign that you can see is bringing things to a screeching halt?
Well, I know what happened when I was causing problems in your campaign is you took me aside and said, hey, man, don't do that. And I really appreciated that. No, I'm just kidding, of course.
I don't remember any of that, actually.
But, I mean, the people that you play with, unless you're playing in a convention environment, and I've even done this in convention environments, is if you see problems, talk to them. I mean, even if you don't know them, they've sat down at a table, they want to play a game with you, they're your friends. Treat them like your friends, right? And, I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, hey, man, you're awesome. Sometimes friends tell friends when they're doing bad things. And talk it out. Let them know that what they're doing is either causing problems or downright unacceptable, and let them make their own decisions. Sometimes you've got that disruptive player and you can't fix the problem. Well, never play a game with somebody you don't enjoy playing with. And that goes for everybody sitting around on the game table. If you're not getting along, well, maybe you shouldn't be playing a game together. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, I think you have to show your players that kind of respect and basically be able to say to them, look, I think that maybe what you're doing is problematic, or you probably want to be a little more diplomatic than that. Say, hey, listen, I've noticed some tension in the gaming group, and I've seen inter-party conflict, or inter-player conflict, I should say, ruin a lot of campaigns. And so one of the keys to a good long-running campaign is a good set of players. Now, we don't want to tell people, you know, oh, well, ditch your friends if they're not, you know, producing a good campaign. But if you want to run a certain kind of campaign and maybe three of the players want to play in that kind of campaign but one guy doesn't, maybe you just want to say to that guy, hey, you know, you're my friend, you're still welcome to come play, but we're going to run this style of campaign, and the longer you continue to rail against it, the more problems it's going to cause. I've had to tell people, you know, look, you're my friend, we've been playing Star Wars for years now, but I really want to run a campaign without any Jedi, and if this is going to be a deal breaker for us, maybe you just sit this one out and come back next time.
Yeah, sometimes you got to do that.
Yeah, I think it's great if you can accommodate all your players, and I think it's something we should all strive for, but there's going to come tipping points sometimes where it's either a player or a campaign, and you've got to ask yourself, do I want to change the whole campaign? And, you know, sometimes that's the answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I say, well, you know what? I really want, you know, this guy to play in my game. I really enjoy having him around, and we're all just friends here, so let's try and accommodate everyone. And then sometimes you're going to want to ask them to change or leave, and I think that's just an unfortunate inevitability of such a socially focused hobby.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you have to have a backbone about it as well. You have to be diplomatic. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's a bad friend who, you know, treats your friends roughly. But I mean, I know a lot of times I get new players and they say, this is what I want to play and this is what I will play. And you gotta stand up to those folks sometimes and say, actually, you know, we're not playing that kind of game. Just to let you know, right? I mean, there's plenty of options that you can have, and I'm trying to get to know your play style and everything. So let's come up with compromise. Compromise is always good.
Yeah, it's critical. So that actually does remind me, though, one of the kind of house rules I've implemented in some of my classic era campaigns is the one Jedi, one droid, one alien rule. Now, I know I've told you about this before, but mm-hmm. basically what I say is I get all my players together. I say, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. Aliens are really popular. Jedi are really popular. Droids can be really popular depending on your gaming group. I want to produce an authentic Star Wars classic trilogy campaign experience. So instead of having everyone play their alien droid Jedis, I want the group to come together to discuss your characters. We can have one non-human, one droid, and one Jedi. And now maybe that means you've got an alien Jedi, and he takes up those two spots. Maybe it means you've got, I don't know, an alien and a droid and a Jedi separately, so that, you know, three players can have those things. How do you feel about rules like that?
Oh, no, I think rules like that are absolutely fine. I mean, in fact, coming up with kind of very loose pre-made backgrounds that allow characters to jump into plot threads is another way of doing that. Like somebody's got to be the Drifter, right? Why? Because you've got this idea of what's going to happen down the line for the Drifter. And making those things that aren't so restrictive that people can't play the characters that they want, or so loose that people can kind of put their own take on those general ideas, is always a great way to start a campaign.
Yeah, it's sort of that give and take between what the players want and what the game masters want. Because right. In the end, a good campaign is fulfilling for both the players and the game master, right? I mean, if I'm the game master and I'm not engaged, right, if I don't want to run a Jedi-heavy game, or if I really don't like a certain plot there that my players do like, you know, sometimes I just have to suck it up and say, you know what, my players like this, so I'm going to do my best to entertain them. And then sometimes you have to say, well, you know what, maybe it's time to compromise a little bit. Maybe it's time for me to make myself happy, too. I've seen a lot of campaigns burst into flames because the game master is just like, you know what, I'm sick of running this prequel era campaign focused on pod racing. I'm really tired of, you know, this campaign focused on the Star Wars pop singer, right? It's just, if a game master's not enjoying himself, it can be destructive to the campaign.
That's very true. That's the cooperative storytelling part of Star Wars and other role-playing games, is you've got to be cooperative.
Yeah, that's true. Well, after our riveting discussion of campaigns, we want to move into the final segment of our podcast, something we're going to be doing during every podcast, and we're going to call it the mailbag segment. I know that's a terribly original name, but what we did was a few months ago, we put out the call for email questions sent to our special feedback email address, which is swfeedback@wizards.com. You can email your questions to us there, but we've got a few questions that we picked out of the hat that I think are questions that a lot of people want to know about, and we're going to go ahead and let Steven get us kicked off with the first one.
Oh, I'm starting. I didn't even... Let me go into the bag.
Okay.
There we go. Oh, this is from Benton Sartori. He asks, in the Saga Edition Core rulebook, the five classes were set up with very different basic talent trees that easily fit into the roles. The noble gets social talents, the soldier gets combat talents, etc. With the basics laid out, what will future products introduce for talent trees? Will they expand on these themes and add more talents to existing trees? Or are these talent trees set in stone and we will only get new talent trees in the future?
Well, I think you can help me answer this one a little bit as well, because you worked on Knights of the Republic. But basically, as we showed a little bit in Starships of the Galaxy, one of the things we want to do is, in our upcoming source books, we want to introduce both new talents for existing trees and new talent trees as a whole. We don't want to introduce any new core classes, I will say that much. Mm-hmm. We've decided so far that the five we've got are serviceable, but you will see new talents and new talent trees for all of those. Kind of the same thing goes for prestige classes as well. While we had a really good cross-section in the beginning, we don't really need to do things like a naval officer prestige class when we can just do a naval officer talent tree for the officer talent tree. Likewise, the Jedi Knight, right? If we suddenly decide we want to do, I don't know, a Jedi Battlemaster prestige class, well, we don't really do a whole prestige class.
No.
We can just do a
talent tree.
Yeah.
Which we did, quite a bit. It's actually really kind of liberating, as if we because by adding on talents to or talent trees to the classes, we can play off things that are already there and already interesting, and then give people more options for the characters that they already know and love.
Yeah, I think it adds a lot to the flexibility to be able to say, you know what, maybe we want to introduce some really great new lightsaber combat talents, for example, right? But instead,
is that happening?
No, yeah, shockingly, the Knights of the Republic campaign setting will have new lightsaber-oriented talents. I know that's, you know, very surprising.
Are lightsabers
surprising.
A big part of this game? I've never realized that before.
You know, you'd think that they were just kind of a secondary concern, but no, yes, in fact, we do have some new lightsaber talents coming up in that one, as well as in other books. But it does let us say, you know what, this would work really well with that block talent, for example. Mm-hmm. Just actually to give a good concrete example, in the Knights of the Old Republic book, we've got a new talent coming out called Riposte. And Riposte basically lets you do the same thing for the block talent that Redirect Shot does for the deflect talent. Meaning when that Dark Jedi comes running up to you and slashes at you with his lightsaber, you get a chance to strike him back.
Always a good thing.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, I think that adding new talent trees is going to be the way to go. Now, we are going to do new prestige classes from time to time. Each of the campaign guides will feature a few, some as few as three. I believe one of our upcoming books has as many as five new prestige classes in it, but those will typically be reserved for things we need whole new mechanics for, new mechanics during the even level, non-talent levels. So, yeah, that's basically the best way that we're going to be able to create new and flexible mechanics without completely invalidating your character. Now, this also has a nice side effect of, if I'm playing in an ongoing campaign and I've invested a lot of resources into getting that bounty hunter prestige class, right? And suddenly a new bounty hunter talent tree comes out, I'm not left having to either rebuild my character or having to bend the rules to get to use this new talent tree.
Yeah, new toys open up immediately without you having to jump through too many hoops, which is a lot of fun. And I think, it's Star Wars, and we definitely play within the rules, but we've also tried to push the envelope quite a bit with those talent trees and finding new space for classes to really shine in directions that are good for their role but have interesting new side effects. So I think people are going to be really happy with what they see in mostly Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah, one of the design guidelines, in fact, for talent trees is if we introduce a new talent tree, we want to show people that this is going to fundamentally change the way your character plays. Now, you might just dip in for one level or two, but we've definitely got some, especially on the prestige class side of things, that if you start taking talents from this tree, it's really going to change the way you behave, both, well, especially in combat, but also in the setting at large.
Right.
Yeah. Liam McCauley in Newcastle, United Kingdom. Wow, one from overseas. We're already popular. Asks, what do you think are the essential elements that make a Star Wars adventure Star Wars?
Action. I mean, even though I talked a little bit about kind of easing new players in, one of the things that is always fun about Star Wars is action and adventure and also finding out layers upon layers of your character as well. I think those three things are really what makes Star Wars tick. If you sit there and watch the movies and you really think about, well, what's exciting, right? Well, finding out, I mean, I remember when I was back when I was a kid, seeing the end of Empire Strikes Back, that's the whole layers. Oh, really? I didn't see that one coming. I mean, it seems elementary now, but finding out that what your destiny is, what the universe actually looks like in a very sort of action-adventure format is exactly what Star Wars is.
I think that's true. One of the things I like to include in my adventures is a kind of a swashbuckling element, right, where you can do incredible things. You can swing across that pit on the Death Star on your grappling hook, for example. Lots of settings and backdrops that facilitate that kind of cinematic, high action. I like to see my Jedi players play a lot like Errol Flynn, right? That kind of swinging from the chandeliers, leaping over chasms, lots of set pieces that facilitate that. I think that's one of the things that makes a Star Wars adventure unique, in that unlike a lot of other science fiction role-playing games, for example, part of the focus is going to be doing the daring, right? Doing things that are exceptional.
You shouldn't be talking to computers the whole time.
No, that's true.
Right.
Maybe not even, you know, sometimes you want to hunker down behind the bunker, but sometimes you want to charge that room full of stormtroopers. And I think that's what we see in the Star Wars films. And if you can create encounters and scenes like that in your role-playing game, then you will succeed in capturing that feel. You want to put players in situations where they have all the tools they need to do fun cinematic things.
Mm-hmm. And definitely incent risk-taking. I mean, risk-taking is always a gamble, but that's always the fun part about Star Wars, is just about every single one of those characters, except for maybe C-3PO, was taking risks at all points of time. And that's what R2 was there for, making sure that C-3PO would take some risks as well. But risk-taking is fun. It's Star Wars. Do it.
No, I agree. One of the funny things that I get a lot, people are always asking me, well, I want to create a character that, you know, doesn't have a lot of value in combat, but he's really good at being a slicer. Or I want to create a character he's a diplomat, but maybe he's not so great in a combat scenario. I actually personally believe that there's no reason why you can't do both, right? There's no reason why your crazy slicer or awesome mechanic can't also be an incredible, you know, an incredible fighter as well.
Right. Yeah, everybody. I mean, Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, they're both incredible pilots, Anakin Skywalker as well, but they were so much more than that. I think that's Star Wars characters in a lot of ways are larger than life, and you should embrace that larger than life when you play them, and don't limit it to just one or two things. Always have a pistol or a lightsaber nearby, because you're going to need it. So this one comes from Mike Medlock. What are some of your favorite non-official resources for the Star Wars RPG?
That's actually kind of an interesting question that I can't answer directly, not because we're not allowed to, but rather because we don't really use non-official resources. That's one of the kind of big bugaboos that Lucasfilm has, is everything we do has to come from an official source. Now, sometimes we are that official source, right? But that's the reason why we have, in our gaming library, we have, I think, maybe missing one or two items, the entire run of West End Games Star Wars books,
yeah,
which is pretty impressive. But I must also say that I have a matching collection at home that I've accumulated over the years.
I've seen it. I've drooled over it.
It's true. It's very large, and I like it. But yeah, so we're not allowed to use any non-official sources. Now, one thing I do like to do is I spend a lot of time on message boards. I used to joke that I'm addicted to the internet, which is pretty much true. I spend a lot of time on message boards or listening to other Star Wars role-playing game podcasts or things like that, because I want to get a sense of what the community is enjoying about the game, what they're not liking. I know that when I'm outlining future books, one of the things I do is I say, you know, I've seen a lot of complaints that element X of the game isn't getting fleshed out enough. And so I'll say, you know what, let's do that in this book. So if you want to call message boards and player feedback a non-official resource, which I would, then that's probably my number one resource.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I'm an infamous lurker on message boards, and I always like to see the things that people gravitate to or not gravitate to or complain vehemently about or sit there and say, hey, I love. And that always in some way affects my opinion.
That's true. Our next question comes from Thor Thorsum, who also gets the award for the best name of anyone that sent us an email. Thor asks, is it at all possible to have the average Star Wars gamer be able to submit their ideas and have them included in any future product?
Well, we were the average Star Wars gamer at one point in time.
That's true.
So, yes.
Sort of. Yeah, it's a little more complicated answer. A little more complicated answer than that. Unfortunately, we don't accept any unsolicited material. That's just a Wizards policy. We have in the past, and in fact, I actually got my start by creating a whole bunch of unofficial fan material. I know, shocking. I ran a pretty extensive website, and that's actually how I got my start. Is one day, many moons ago, Chris Perkins and J.D. Weicker came to me and said, you know what, we've seen the quality of material you've been putting out. We would love to have you do some work for us. Now, that's kind of rare, but in a more direct way, one of the best ways, if you think you have the chops to pull off freelance writing, one of the best ways to make that happen is to come talk to us at conventions.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming to talk to us at conventions is always good. And we get to know you. We'll know where to look. Writing for other people, and so we can just kind of take a look at your writing chops and your design chops and everything else is always a good thing as well. Working on Dungeons and Dragons would probably help you in the long run as well. So there's while we don't take unsolicited stuff, I know that Dragon and Dungeon do take queries, so you could try that route as well.
That's right, and definitely having a good writing resume is one way to have you be taken seriously if you are looking to write freelance. So there are a number of ways to go about it, but there's not going to be any sort of open call for Star Wars or Congress. I think that about wraps up our time for this podcast. I'd like to thank Stephen for joining me today. It's been really great.
I've had a great time. Thanks for having me along, Rodney.
Don't forget to tell your friends and fellow Star Wars fans about this podcast, which you can download for free from www.wizards.com/Star Wars. And remember, if you have any questions you'd like to hear answered in our mailbag segment, you can send them to swfeedback@wizards.com. And we'll do our best to answer any that we can. This concludes this episode of the podcast. Thanks for listening, and may the Force be with you.
Don't get technical with me.